Our next case this morning is State v. Decker.
Good morning, Judge Cox, Judge Mann, Presiding Judge Leach. May it please the court, my name is Andrew McGee. I'm present on behalf and along with Mr. Decker, who is seated in the back of the courtroom. We're here to appeal. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Of the 10 minutes that were provided, I'd respectfully request that 3 minutes be reserved for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor. This matter that we're here about today results from Mr. Decker being put on trial. When he was put on trial, on the day of trial, he had two counts of assault brought against him by the state. The result of the jury verdict on count one, I've referred to it in our briefing, is that he was found not guilty, and by special verdict, not guilty by way of self-defense, and under the law was to be awarded his reasonable costs and attorney's fees.
Now, you say reasonable costs and attorney's fees. Doesn't the statute require that they be expenses that were actually incurred?
I would say no. The statute, I believe, reads reasonable attorney's fees,
amount. All reasonable costs, including loss of time, legal fees incurred, and other expenses involved in his or her defense. So the modifier of legal fees is incurred.
And what I would submit, Your Honor, is that it's under the rubric of that which are reasonable, and that the lodestar method therefore would apply, which is not necessarily actual attorney's fees incurred, but the reasonable attorney's fees incurred.
So if we disagree with that argument, where are you left in terms of the right to receive any fees for your client?
Well, if that were the case, in speaking only hypothetically and not conceding the point, but understanding your question, what would he be due if it were not the lodestar method, I think we would then be veering towards what I think is a legally flawed argument that he would then have to show what he was actually, those which he was actually incurred.
Would you agree the record contains no evidence of the actual fees incurred?
That's correct. And I would also say that that's not what's required, either by lodestar and or the statute. The statute is invoked upon the special verdict finding by the jury. And that special verdict is tried at a civil standard. It is not the more beyond a reasonable doubt that the not guilty verdict was arrived at. But the jury is usually...
But that special verdict only establishes the state's liability for some amount of fees. It doesn't address the amount that's to be awarded, does it?
That's correct, Your Honor. And what my point was going to be is that as a civil verdict, that's why we apply the lodestar method, as I put and cited in the briefing as the McGreevy case.
What would we say in our opinion about what the meaning of the word incurred is in the statute?
Incurred would be that which was reasonably incurred.
Well, one way to look at that is that lawyers charge fees, but they're subject to the limitation that the fees may be reasonable. That's an RPC limitation.
Correct.
That's a way to read this, that it doesn't just whatever the lawyer charged the client, but there's a ceiling on it, and that's the ceiling of reasonableness.
And I believe that that standard would carry over here, and therefore the lodestar method is what's applied. Nowhere in the statute, and there's no case law that says, except I believe what the state argues in their briefing with regard to the Anderson case and then Jones, which says that the only time that what is actually incurred comes into play is when a person is represented by appointed counsel. That's the only case law that they cite, and it's the only case law that I find which was confirmed subsequently by Division II, Division II also being the court that produced the Anderson opinion. And what Division II says is that the only time we look at what they actually incurred is when they have an attorney appointed them by the state and therefore incurred no expense whatsoever.
Well, but what they say in Anderson is we hold that, and identify the statute, is an indemnification reimbursement statute. Indemnification and reimbursement sound like words to repay what somebody either paid or owed. If we look at the reasoning rather than just the result of Anderson, how do we distinguish those words from your advocacy for the Lodestar approach?
I believe it would be, if I understand your question correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that Anderson and Jones, as I've stated with regard to Jones, as it reiterates that when an accused is indigent, he or she is entitled to counsel at public expense. Once he or she has such counsel, he or she cannot reasonably incur fees for attorney services, at least in most instances, because he or she already has such services. We hold that the state is not required to compensate for attorney's fees incurred by Jones while he had court-appointed counsel. It's limited to that circumstance. Now,
well, the court went on to say that neither word commands the state to pay fees that the defendant has neither paid nor become legally obligated to pay. The Lodestar approach would allow a court to award fees that a defendant has not paid and may not have become legally obligated to pay. What would we do in the situation where the lawyer charges a flat fee, thinking it's going to be a very simple case of $1,500? He ends up in a two-week trial and incurs $100,000 worth of time. But the lawyer's true to his word and only charges his client $1,500. What's the defendant entitled to recover upon a successful self-defense?
If, by way of affidavit, the defense attorney in that situation submitted what I believe you're describing as his actual time spent at his reasonable hourly rate based on the Lodestar method of arriving at those, then in that circumstance, the not the attorney, but the client would be due that higher amount, not necessarily what he actually paid.
What legislative policy would we be furthering with that result?
The policy, the public policy would be that, very simply, that the state, remember, this is all arising out of a statute that is, if I can put it this way, and I think it's reasonable to put it this way, is punitive against the state. They're being held liable for bringing a case against someone, which the jury has communicated to them clearly that based on the same evidence that they had before them, the state, the jury has looked at that evidence and said, you should have never charged this person. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ian Eath, representing the state of Washington in this matter. I will only address the reimbursement issue unless your honors have questions about the other issues, which frankly the state regard as frivolous. As to the reimbursement issue, the state is asking this court to, well, first affirm Mr. Decker's conviction, of course, but to vacate the trial court's order of $11,760 in self-defense reimbursement, because Mr. Decker concedes that he has never proven that he personally has incurred any losses or debt at all in this case.
Let me ask you this question. If we assume the Lodestar method applies to a calculation under the statute, just an assumption for this purpose, isn't there another problem here is in that there's no segregation between successful defense and unsuccessful defense?
Yes, sir. In fact, I would just, that was sort of the second stage of my argument, which is even presuming that this Lodestar method that Mr. Decker is proffering is the correct one, which we vehemently oppose. Mr. Decker never supplied the trial court with anything sufficient for the trial court to arrive at a reasonable attorney's award to Mr. Decker. The key, whether you follow Lodestar or whether you follow all the case law that says that this is not a reasonable attorney's fees statute, the key word that is unique to or common in both methods is the term reasonable. In this case, the trial court abused its discretion because it essentially picked a number out of thin air. As you point out, Judge Cox, Mr. Decker's attorney presented an affidavit asking for $76,000, I believe is the total. The trial court looked at a page and a half worth of expenses that Mr. McGee proffered he had rang up, and it arrived at 15%. It never explained where it got 15%. There was never any evidence presented from Mr. Decker that count two only took 15% of his time, while count one took the other 85% of his time. So in this particular case, there's nothing presented.
Any evidence that was offered in support of count two that would not have been presented had Mr. Decker been tried only on count one?
Absolutely not. The record reflects that Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Chandler were assaulted almost simultaneously in the same course of conduct that Mr. Decker engaged in that day at the parking lot. The two pepper spray incidents were separated in time by seconds. So even had the state only proceeded, for example, as originally charged with two victims named in one count, or it only proceeded to trial on Mr. Chandler and not Mr. O'Brien, the fact that Mr. Decker pepper sprayed the other teenager would have been part of the res geste of the case. It was all wrapped up in the same event. There's no evidence put before the trial court that Mr. McGee spent any time investigating, preparing, or developing this case as two individually separate trials whatsoever. So when he comes to the trial court at the end of the story and says that it racked up $78,000 worth of attorney fees on a three-day assault trial, he should have presented the trial court with more than just a quick rundown of time that he claims he spent on the case, which included, by the way, 4 hours that he claimed to have spent on pretrial hearings that lasted mere minutes.
Now, does that really tell us anything? I mean, I've spent 2 minutes on a motion sometimes, but I sat 2 hours waiting for my turn to talk, and I billed my client for the whole time I sat in the courtroom, not just the 2 minutes I was talking.
That could be. I would say that the record...
That's a very good argument.
Well, I think the record reflects that that's not the case in this particular... in these cases. But be that as it may, the trial court still wasn't equipped to arrive at a reasonable award for Mr. Decker, A, because he never proved that he incurred any costs of his own, and at the end of the day, the trial court simply picked a number out of the air. It just said, okay, fine, I'm going to give 15% of what you're asking for, but I'm not going to explain why. So with that, the state asked this court to vacate the order because the trial court abused its discretion in arriving at any amount. And Mr. Decker has been asked time and again to provide proof in some form that he has actually incurred a cost in this case or has actually incurred a debt in this case. And he has conspicuously refused to do so, including today. So at this point, Your Honor, we believe that this order should be vacated. If Your Honors have any questions about the other issues on appeal, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Your Honors, if I may follow up on the question that I was asked before the state presented their argument, I believe it was a question about why it would be a good policy to apply Lodestar. Very simply, the policy would be that the defendant who prevailed in this situation, it's a mini hearing, it's a trial unto itself. You make a separate argument to the jury after the verdict has been turned in. That may not have the grandeur and length and development of a full trial, but both sides present arguments to the jury. And the jury returned a verdict that Mr. Decker was not only not guilty, but he was due his cost. It was more probably than not self-defense.
Well, let me tell you the problem I'm having with the policy you advanced in your direct argument. We generally do not allow punitive damages in the state of Washington, and when we are awarding people damages, it's to make them whole, meaning to provide them back what they have lost, which is, I think, why the court talks in Anderson about reimbursement and indemnification, and it's very carefully choosing those words rather than something else. And what would be different here if the legislature was trying to do something more than just to make the defendant whole? It's been pretty obscure about how it went about doing that.
Well, the first thing I would refer to is the fact that the lodestar method does exist. I think we can all agree on that. It may not apply here, arguably, but it does exist. Now, and it exists.
And lawyers have tried to avoid that by writing contracts that provide for one party to have to pay the actual fees incurred by the other side rather than reasonable fees. I mean, that's been the drafting response.
And that goes to the problems that I'll first point out. I don't believe there's anything that says, other than Anderson, which is in a very limited context with regard to it being a public defender, essentially, an appointed attorney, that other than that context, the problem will be, first of all, lodestar does apply. Maybe not here, but we say it does. There's no case law that says that it doesn't. The only case law that the state cites is Anderson, which is a limited context and doesn't get in the way of lodestar applying here. The most important reason about it is to make the person whole is to, in lodestar, where it applies universally in all other cases, I'll say, overreaching a bit, but the point being that where it exists, is that in those cases, you don't have to show what is actually incurred. You show what was reasonably incurred. It's very, very well laid out in McCreevy what the standard is. The state says we conspicuously didn't disclose what my contract, the confidential arrangement between my client and me, says. Well, does that mean I can write up a contract and say, as you pointed out, Your Honor, why don't I just write all my fee agreements to be $100 million? What's reasonable, et cetera? Thank you, Your Honor.